Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Monday, December 16th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the weekend's box office numbers, and we'll answer a couple of your emails. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film staff writer and box office analyst Ryan Scott.
Hey, everyone. How's it going?
Ryan, it's been a little while since we've dipped into the mailbag, so I wanted to read a few listener emails. Terry from Oakland, California wrote in, "Love the podcast. I've been listening to it from day one, although I often disagree with what I hear. I love the conversation and the different perspectives. It's always a joy to hear Chris's dour voice. It warms the cackles of my heart." I love that. Thank you, Terry. Okay, back to Terry's email. "As far as the top five Denzel movies, I'm pretty sure I was, like many of your other Black listeners, screaming at our phones or whatever they listen to podcasts on. You all made some great points and had some great picks. There were some deep cuts in there. I appreciate you highlighting the relationship between Denzel and Spike Lee. They are cinematic gold. But to be clear, there's no way Man on Fire sits on that list over Glory. I understand the desire to want to have quote-unquote action Denzel on the list. I think for a lot of people, Training Day is action Denzel turned up. I think all of those Tony Scott action movies and Training Day have a similar version of Denzel. Glory is different. The rawness of his acting, the hint of charm beneath that rage, the arc of his character, it really mirrors the arc of Malcolm X. I saw both of those movies in the theater and they had a profound impact on many of us. Man on Fire was great, but doesn't rank as one of his top five greatest performances. Macbeth must be on the list, although I would have had Mo Betta Blues and Mississippi Masala deserves an honorable mention. Love you guys." So I just wanted to share some feedback from that because that's one of my favorite episodes we've done recently, ranking our sort of group collective top five Denzel Washington movies list. It was just such a tough conversation to have because Denzel is awesome and there are so many great movies in that filmography. So thanks for the feedback, Terry, there. I certainly respect the opinion there. And I'm glad he mentioned Mississippi Masala. That's been on my list of things to watch for years. And I think it's streaming on the Criterion channel right now. And I really need to buckle down and check that one out. It's supposed to be a really good movie. I've heard fantastic things about it. It's like a romance with Denzel from like the early 90s, I think. So
yeah, that's one I haven't seen as well. But and I know you guys got into this on the podcast, but it is interesting when you're ranking like an actor's movies, right? And you say a Denzel Washington movie. So okay, so is a movie that Denzel is in, like even if it's a better movie, is it a quote unquote Denzel movie in the way that like Training Day is a Denzel movie? And that's where you get caught in the weeds. Because you know, with Glory, I would say I don't know if it's as much of a quote unquote Denzel movie as like Man on Fire is. So I would actually lean toward Man on Fire in that one. But, you know.
Yep. Okay. Andrew from Wichita wrote in, and I want to address Andrew's question to you here, Ryan. So think about that as I read this. Andrew writes, "I subscribe to Peacock and Paramount Plus. Each year, I wait until Black Friday when they offer deals and then subscribe. This year, for example, Peacock is offering a full year for $20. How do these deals keep these streaming services alive?" So, Ryan, do you have an answer to that?
I do. So in a lot of cases, the deals are for new subscribers only, or there is at least a limit on, you know, if you subscribed at one point, but, you know, you need to at least wait a while. Like I know Audible's deals work that way where like if you took Audible up on some deal, you have to wait a certain amount of time before you can like take another deal. So that's one. Number two, it's all about getting like juicing the subscriber numbers, particularly for ones that need it. So like, you know, Peacock in particular, we haven't talked about it as much recently, but Peacock and Paramount Plus are the two that I look at right now. And I'm like, I don't see them surviving the streaming wars as is, particularly Peacock. I think Peacock should have, I think NBC should have set Peacock down a couple years ago, but whatever. But they desperately need to inflate those numbers. So, you know, one way you do that is a deal. And then the hope is that if people like that enough or they just forget, they'll just let the subscription, you know, renew again. And there you go. You just get people in the ecosystem. So that's really what it is. And then, you know, when you have the quarterly earnings call, you can go, oh, we gained, you know, X million number of subscribers this quarter or whatever. And even if part of that is goosed by incredibly cheap subscriptions, you know, so be it. It's the same way that like certain cell phone carriers or internet companies have deals with like Netflix or other streaming services. You know, that's not necessarily full price either, but, you know, it's a way to juice the subscriber numbers. That's ultimately what it is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they must have run the numbers on their end and realized that like it's not going to completely tank their business model to do this. Otherwise, they wouldn't keep offering the deals. And like
in Peacock's case, they don't really have a business strategy that I can discern. I just imagine increasing the numbers. Look, I don't mean to be hard on Peacock, but they're the one streamer out there that they just never. The losses have only piled up, and there just hasn't been like. Like, I don't think Ted season 2 is going to get him out of the red. You know what I mean? Like it's tough to see the forest through the trees with that one.
Yeah. Some of the other industry podcasts and stuff that I listen to have praised Peacock for the Olympics coverage that they had this year. And evidently that gave them like a big boost. And then also they got into streaming some NFL stuff this year.
They did.
And that was like a massive, massive boon for them. And so if they can loop more of that into their coverage and sort of become like a must watch destination for sports fans for live sports coverage, that might be a way that they could, I don't know, maybe prolong the inevitable or something. I tend to agree with you that like over the long term, they're probably not going to last, but they may be able to stick around for a little while longer.
Well, the other issue is that more. Yeah, no, because I was going to bring that up is that the way that these like Black Friday deals work, they work almost in a similar way as to like, if you have me as like a hardcore NFL fan and Peacock is the home to is the exclusive home to a playoff NFL game, well, guess who's getting my money at least for a month, you know? Mm-hmm. but then I will quickly, you know, cancel. And but yeah, the Olympics, you know, were a big boon for them, but and yes, they got a boost of subscribers, but my question remains is how many of those people stick around for more than a couple of months, you know? And yep. I think that's the issue is how quickly and also Peacock is pretty much only exclusively domestic, you know, whereas like even HBO Max, or I'm sorry, just Max is rolling out internationally, you know, and things like that. It, you know, so it just gets tricky. I fail to see the long-term effectiveness of the business model, but, and this might be a conversation for another podcast, but sports are becoming the last land grab in streaming where like Netflix is streaming 2 NFL games on Christmas Day, you know? And so, you know, it's not just Peacock either. So those NFL games and those other sports rights, if Peacock did fold, those could go somewhere else and someone else would be very happy to pay for them is all I will say.
Mm-hmm. All right. So the last email I wanted to read comes from Richard from San Antonio. Love the show and I listen to every episode. I hate to be that guy, but the way you have all pronounced Dietrich Bonhoeffer's name kills me every time. And I pronounced it correctly that time, just for the record. I looked it up. I apologize, Richard. Okay. Back to Richard's email. I haven't seen the film, but he's a super interesting historical figure, a German pastor who studied in the States and was influenced by the people he met in Harlem. When he moved back to Germany, he was arrested for plotting to kill Hitler. Otherwise, keep up the good work. So just somebody who was taking issue with some of the pronunciation on the show. I always appreciate if I am mispronouncing anyone's name, please email me and let me know. I want to be as accurate as possible. So thank you to Richard for that. I try when I am trying to pronounce any celebrity's name that I'm unfamiliar with. The best thing to do, I think I've talked about this on the show before, is like try to find a interview clip on YouTube where they're introducing themselves, like saying their own name. That's the best way to do that. I'm pretty sure Dietrich Bonhoeffer is not alive, but
yeah, I do that every single time. I've interviewed Jaime Colette Serra three times, and every time I watched, I still don't even know if I have that right, but like every time I like before I talk to him, I like watch someone say his name like 8 times to try to get it right.
That's one that that trips me up too. I've seen it pronounced so many different ways over the years. So okay, thank you Richard for the email. Thank you all for writing into us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. if you have anything you want to say, shoot us an email, we'd appreciate it. Okay, let's get now into the box office discussion, Ryan. So tell me what the top 10 movies were at the domestic box office this past weekend.
Will do. We are coming in toward the end of the year here, so we're trying to bring this thing in for a landing. We've had a couple of, ever since Barbenheimer, we've had some interesting box office matchups over the years. Nobody really came up with a cute name for Kraven the Hunter versus the Lord of the Rings, the War of the Rohirrim, but let's just say Barbenheimer, it was not. Coming in at number one for the weekend, and its third weekend in a row, was Moana 2. $26.6 million dropped less than 50%. It has already overtaken the entire domestic total of the original Moana. It has passed $700 million worldwide. It is well on its way to $1 billion globally. That has proved to be a fantastic decision on Disney's part to not make that a Disney Plus series. And number two, holding on to the number two spot again, is Wicked, with another $22.5 million, dropping just 38% in its fourth weekend. This movie is crushing. It has cleared $500 million worldwide as of now, heavily weighted domestically, but still very good. It is probably going to get to at least $600 million, so this is kind of our Wonka of the year, if you will. Number three, Kraven the Hunter, Sony's latest Spider-Man villain spinoff film, tanked and tanked badly with just an $11 million domestic debut. It had a $110 million budget. We will talk more about that in a minute. At number four is Gladiator 3 in its fourth weekend with $7.8 million, dropping just 38%. It is only a couple of million dollars away from crossing the $400 million mark worldwide. So I guess at this point, is it going to get to profitability in the theaters? No. Is it going to at least save itself from being a complete disaster? Probably. All right. At number five, we have The Lord of the Rings, The War of the Rohirrim, the anime film set in the world of J.R.R. Tolkien's work. $4.6 million debut on over 2,600 screens. This was a pure and total flop, no way about it, but we will talk about that more in a minute because there is an interesting wrinkle here. At number six, we have Red One with $4.4 million in its fifth weekend. It is coming up on $200 million worldwide. It's at 175 right now. It'll at least get close to that. So, you know, say what you will, but theaters could use that money. At number seven, we have sort of something that is building on what I will call the RRR effect. Pushpa, The Rule Part 2, in its second weekend, made $3.7 million on just 631 screens, meaning it had a per-screen average north of $5,800. That's, I mean, you know, for those theaters that had it, that's a hell of a boon. At number eight, we have Christopher Nolan's Interstellar in its second weekend of re-release with another $3.3 million on just 321 screens for a stellar per-screen average of $10,327. The re-release has now made almost $12 million in the States alone. At number nine, we have a very different type of Interstellar in the form of Interstellar 5555, The Story of the Secret Star System. For those that don't know what this is an anime film that was based on Daft Punk's album Discovery, and it has sort of been away for a long time, and it brought back as a theatrical release. It was on just 641 screens. It made $2.3 million, so again, another very interesting sort of specialty release here. And rounding out the top 10, we have the best Christmas pageant ever still hanging in there through the holiday season with another $1.3 million. That one has made $36.6 million domestically alone. Again, a pretty solid hit for Lionsgate there. They needed it badly.
Okay, well, with that, let's take a break, and then we'll come back and dig into those numbers a little bit closer.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, Ryan, let's get into it. I think maybe the one thing that I wanted to talk about first, even though it's not the most important story here, you alluded to a wrinkle with Lord of the Rings, The War of the Rohirrim, and we devoted this past Friday's episode to that show. I had some great conversations with the folks who made it, even though I was a little mixed on the movie itself. But tell me about that wrinkle that you alluded to.
Yeah, for sure. So I had actually speculated a little bit about this on Friday, but what's interesting is Warner Brothers kind of just said the quiet part out loud here. So here's the thing. The Lord of the Rings movies, meaning the Lord of the Rings trilogy and The Hobbit, they have made nearly $6 billion collectively worldwide. This is an incredibly valuable piece of IP. So, you know, doing an animated spinoff seemed somewhat logical, but it did seem announced out of nowhere. And then several months after that, we learned that Warner Brothers is working on new live action Lord of the Rings films. And, you know, Amazon has the rights to the Rings of Power, and it seemed like the rights were, you know, potentially going to be, you know, changing hands there for a bit. So everyone was wondering what was going on. Well, Warner Brothers straight up just said, so here's a statement from WB. This is from Warner Brothers. Announced in June 2021, Lord of the Rings, The War of the Rohirrim was fast-tracked to ensure New Line Cinema did not lose the film adaptation rights for Tolkien's novels, while Lord of the Ring trio, Peter Jackson, Fran Walsh, and Philippa Boyens, worked through a creative vision for the next live-action movies in the Lord of the Rings series. So, Warner Brothers straight up came out and said, we greenlit this movie to not lose the rights to the franchise, period. It was a $30 million investment in them keeping the rights to the Lord of the Rings. And, you know, again, it is highly unusual for a studio to just come out and say that.
It is. And, you know, we've seen this before. Obviously, like, we'll talk about that more with Kraven. That's very much a similar type of scenario with what Sony is doing with the rights to the Marvel characters that they have. That is interesting. I do think, like, the $30 million budget helps this movie, right, in the long run, because it'll probably continue to get featured in, you know, this seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, or correct me if you have a different take on this, Ryan, but it seems to me like a movie that, like, this is kind of a long play. Like, they probably knew this was not going to do gangbusters numbers at the box office, and they assumed that this movie will just sort of continue to slowly make money for them in the long run, right? Like, if it gets packaged with the Lord of the Rings the live action movies in box sets or featured on iTunes or whatever, you know, it's just like one of those things that's just going to be continually presented to fans of the franchise, and like, they're going after completists and people who are interested in all things Tolkien and whatever. So I don't know, is that, I guess, in conjunction with the idea of just the brass tacks aspect of just keeping the rights, is that what you're thinking that this movie was sort of made for?
Yeah, actually, and I will say, like, for one, I appreciate the transparency, right? Like, instead of sort of corporate speak and sort of trying to talk around the point, and because the difference is Sony's not sitting here saying we made Kraven to keep the rights. They're more than meeting their contractual obligations to keep the rights to Spider-Man. So that's just trying to bleed, you know, wring blood from a stone. You know, this, on the other hand, there hadn't been a Lord of the Rings movie in, you know, I guess going on a decade. You know, after Battle of the Five Armies or whatever. So, you know, that was running a true risk of losing the rights or whatever. And they clearly wanted to do more with them. So what's interesting is they were smart enough to go, okay, what story is there to potentially tell here? How can, you know, and look, a $30 million budget is, like you said, it's not the end of the world. So over enough time, because this thing's made $10.5 million globally, it isn't doing particularly well overseas either, but so let's say it can, you know, get to 15 million worldwide. You know, that at least covers whatever they paid for marketing. And then over the life of the movie, between VOD, between Blu-ray, between whatever merch sales there are between this and that, yeah, you could eventually recoup that money. But more than anything, if you just said to Warner Brothers, give us $30 million and you keep the rights to Lord of the Rings, they would probably have said yes to that. You know, so you get something out of it instead of just paying for the rights. You know what I mean? Like, so right. I do see that as somewhat smart business, but you know, it is an interesting prospect, certainly, but yeah, I mean, it's just I can't recall a studio having come out and said straight up, point blank, we only made this movie to keep the rights, you know. So yeah. It is a, you know, it's better than sort of Roger Corman's Fantastic Four, right? Like that, you know what I mean? Like it's an interesting thing.
Yeah,
you know.
Okay, so where do you want to go next? What corner of this top 10 do you want to explore?
I mean, I kind of already broke down the main bullet points here for Moana 2 and Wicked. I just would like to hammer home again that Moana 2 very, very nearly went directly to Disney Plus. And the fact that this movie's going to end up making $1 billion worldwide, given a somewhat, you know, a decent reception compared to the original. It's not like a, you know, as, it doesn't seem to be as praised as the original, but this to me, and I wrote about this for us, I believe this will be the death of the big direct to streaming movie, and it should be, and I hope that it is. Not saying nothing will ever be direct to streaming again, but I think the idea of, like, you know, big IP going direct to streaming, yeah, that might be done. Anyway, yeah. So I guess let's go to Craven then. That's probably the best thing to do.
Yeah, I'm so curious. Like, so you basically laid it out that this movie did not do well, but sort of like put that in context for me. Like, how terribly did this actually perform?
Well, Madame Web, one of the most dunked on movies of the year, one of the bigger flops of the year, opened to north of $15 million. So, you know, this is worse than Madame Web, you know, by a significant amount, quite a bit worse than Morbius. You know, these have gotten worse, not better. I will say what's interesting here. If you go to the old Rotten Tomatoes, for whatever that's worth, 15% critical rating, 73% audience rating. So, you know.
I mean, I don't really know what I'm supposed to take away from that, Ryan, because it seems like 73% is okay, I guess, when it comes to audience scores on Rotten Tomatoes. So it seems like the small amount of people who did see it thought it was okay. Like, is that the takeaway there?
I guess, but it's also just more that is a pretty big, you know, just for example, you know, Madame Web has an 11% critical rating and a 55% audience rating. So like that's closer, you know what I mean? I think that's like a closer, whereas it does seem like the audiences are dissenting a bit. From the critical opinion here, you know, because that's a little closer to Venom numbers, where, you know, the first Venom, I think, has like a 28% critical rating, but like an 80% audience. You know what I mean? That's where so there is a bit of a disagreement here. So this could be one of those things that, because Sony has that output deal with Netflix, where this movie goes to Netflix and then a bunch of people are like, this is cool. What's everyone talking about? You know, I do think your average viewer there might run the risk of that. I don't know why I said risk. Like what you like. I don't care. But I will say that, this is pretty clearly the end of the line for these movies. There have been several different articles from the various trade publications, with some saying the Sony spinoff, Spider-Man spinoff universe is dead, and others being like, Sony's not going to stop making these movies. They just might change. And, you know, there's been all kinds of information floating out there. Like, apparently the entire time Sony could have had Spider-Man in these movies if they wanted. There was nothing that contractually prevented them from doing that. They just chose not to. I sort of understand why they didn't, but it is interesting. I guess that.
Well, tell me why you think they didn't. Was it just a brand management kind of thing?
Like, because what do you do? You can't have Holland be there. I mean, you could, but I don't think he would. One, and two, it's okay. Then what do? You cast a new Spider-Man. You create some brand confusion. You know, I get it. You know, do you risk oversaturating the market? You know, there's a lot of considerations to make there. You know, so
yeah,
I
would think they. I was just going to say, I would think that Sony knew that these movies are not up to the same amount of, or the same level of quality as the Spider-Man movies that they've been making with Marvel Studios. So the idea of plopping the Spider-Man character, who is arguably, and maybe not even arguably, it might just be like straight up the most valuable character that they have, into a movie that they know is objectively not up to snuff. It doesn't really make a lot of sense. It kind of like dings Spider-Man as a character instead of just like this sort of loose idea of, oh, these characters are operating in the Marvel universe and they're probably banking on a lot of people, you know, regular folks, not even really paying that close attention to the difference between a Sony spinoff movie and an MCU movie and whatever, just sort of trying to make, like you said earlier, wring blood from a stone and just make as much as they can from these things. But I think they were smart enough, especially considering how poorly these movies have done, to not just throw Spider-Man in there for the sake of doing it, because that would have been potentially damaging to people's interest in coming back for future Spider-Man, like direct Spider-Man movies instead of these spinoff things.
100%. And I do think this, do I think, because I think that, you know, the one thing is, you know, look, people don't know who Kraven the Hunter is. People like me who love Marvel Comics and Spider-Man is their boy, you know, Kraven is one of Spider-Man's greatest foes. But that's not everyone, you know, like, so, but that's also not necessarily gonna kill you, you know, right off the bat. You know, Iron Man, for as much as he's an A-lister now, and he was always a part of the Avengers, that was not a name everybody knew. But that Iron Man is still considered to be one of the best superhero movies ever made. you know, that gets you pretty far. Mm-hmm. You know, you can take these characters and you can, with the right take and the right movie, you can put them on people's radar. It's possible. But it just, you know, you can't make movies. I understand some people are going to like this movie. That's totally fine. But there are not that many movies with a 15% on Rotten Tomatoes that, you know, are, you know, end up becoming, you know, widely acclaimed, you know, they might gain a cult following at some point, but you know what I mean? They you can only really get so far with that sort of thing. So mm-hmm. I think that the thing is that Spider-Man has a tremendous number of characters attached to him. I believe that there are people out there who are looking at various pieces of Spider-Man lore going, oh my God, we could do something with that. I mean, look right now. Last week we got announced Mike Flanagan, one of the greatest horror filmmakers of the modern era, wrote a Clayface movie for DC, a sort of, you know, in all due respect, a B-tier Batman villain. And mm-hmm. you know, that sounds like it has a lot of potential. You know, there is absolutely an avenue to do that with Spider-Man characters. I bet there are people all over the place who are chomping at the bit that have a story that they would like to tell. You know, so you can still, I still believe there's a way to do this, but whatever path you've been carving, whatever loosely connected universe you've been doing, whatever Sinister Six you've been trying to build up to, whatever this has got to be the end of it. Because again, you know, Madame Web had an $80 million budget. I think Morbius was around 75. And the other interesting thing is that the Variety article that was going around, Sony was insisting that Morbius was profitable. You know, but hey, that's the benefit of a lower budget, but because of the strikes and because of other things, this one ballooned to 110. So, you know, $11 million domestic debut. And just to give everyone the full picture here, it did $15 million overseas. So $26 million global debut for a movie with a $110 million budget. I mean, this thing's going to lose a fortune, you know? So, you know, it's just, you can't keep doing that.
So do you think the future of Sony's plans, do you think they're just going to focus on Spider-Man centric movies? I think that was what the Variety article was sort of alluding to, is they're going to stop with the spinoff of the villain type of approach and move on. But like you said, there's been so much conflicting information out there that I was just curious what you think that they might actually do moving forward.
I think for now, that's certainly the plan. Because, I mean, if you look at it, they have, you know, Beyond the Spider-Verse, which has been, depending on what rumors you decide to believe, has either been entirely scrapped and started over, delay, whatever. But either way, the one report said it's not coming out in 2025. So we have to wait till at least 2026 for that. But I don't think that they will do that, because that's the year that Tom Holland Spider-Man 4 comes out. So I would wager we're waiting till 2027 for Beyond the Spider-Verse. So... So let's look at it this way. Give next year off. Just let Sony take a breather, get their ducks in a row. 2026, you come back big with Tom Holland Spider-Man 4. 2027, Beyond the Spider-Verse. And then by then, you're kind of getting to the end of the multiverse saga with the MCU and stuff. Things will be different. Who knows what Spider-Man's plans are? Who knows if Tom Holland will still be around? And as I pitched you a little while ago, I believe that maybe after the multiverse saga, well, then what do? It's been enough time. Beyond the Spider-Verse is out. Miles Morales is an A-list star in his own right. Then you maybe do a Miles Morales live-action trilogy. And then, you know, by the time that runs its course, you could maybe reboot Peter Parker again. So I sort of pitched that a while ago, but I'm making the point that even without these spin-off movies, you could easily see the path for the next 10 years for Sony there. You know, then maybe along the way there, you figure out, okay, maybe we start doing these little, you know, lower budget experimental comic book films, like, because apparently the budget for that Clayface movie is going to be like $40 million. You know, it's like whether or not that sticks, I don't know, but that's an interesting approach to it, right? So like maybe you start doing stuff more like that, because I think unless you have a slam dunk idea, doing a $110 million version of this doesn't make any sense. So, you know, that's sort of my guess. Yeah. You lean into Spider-Man for now, but I think things could change. There were also, again, this is pure rumor, and I don't buy into it at all, but there were even people suggesting that, like, and some middlingly credible people online spouting that, well, this might be the thing that gets Sony to sell the rights back to Marvel, and stranger things have happened. I don't know, but, you know, I doubt that, but, you know, so we'll see how it goes. But I think that this is at the very least, the final nail in the coffin for whatever the hell this was. You know, the Venom movies made money, but you know, that was a the way that I look at it, that was a complete fluke. Venom was maybe the one and only character in Spider-Man's villain catalog that had enough name on his own without a good movie to get people interested, coupled with Tom Hardy, you know. But yeah, just a fascinating run of absolute garbage. I try not to be mean, but like, it is fascinating to me how you make that many movies in a row that are that bad. Absolutely bananas.
Yeah, totally. All right, so what else did you want to touch on here before we call it a day?
We didn't really talk about this a lot last week, but yeah, I mean, bad week for horror. Last week, you know, Y2K, Werewolves, Night Bitch, and Getaway all sort of disappointed. Y2K fell out of the top 10 already this week. It debuted at 9 last weekend, made just $2.1 million. It made well under $1 million this weekend. It was just a $351 per screen average, so that's a pretty... pretty rough one for A24 to swallow there. Yeah, so I mean, you know, I just want to point out that, you know, A24 kind of ending the year on a weak note there. I liked that movie for whatever it is worth.
Yeah, me too.
That doesn't always matter. It is what it is. The only other thing I'd point out is we're getting closer to the kind of Oscar season here. Queer, the latest from Luca Guadagnino, that went to somewhat wide release in 460 theaters, and it made $791,000. It's doing okay, but it might not be enough for A24 to expand that super wide. So that one might not end up getting like an enormous theatrical presence leading up to award season here. We'll see how it goes. I mean, you know, again, these things are, it just depends. You know, usually what's happened the last couple of years is once the Oscar nominations come out, you know, a lot of these movies get a pretty big boost. So, you know, we'll see.
Yeah. But yeah, also have Baby Girl coming up too at the end of the month.
We do. Yeah. So, the Christmas frame. So I guess just looking ahead, you know, in sort of to put a bow on Kraven and Lord of the Rings here, coming up on Friday, we have Sonic 3 and Mufasa. Now, Sonic 3, its prospects keep going up. Mufasa's kind of middling, but in either case, we have two big movies coming that are just going to knock those ones out, like almost completely. Like, I'm expecting massive, massive drop for both of these. And then that leads to a big Christmas Day where we have, like you said, Baby Girl, and then we have Nosferatu, and there are a couple of other movies coming out on Christmas Day as well. So, you know, we should finish the year strong here, very strong actually, but you know, these two movies just weren't didn't really add much to the equation. So I think that's all I've got.
Cool. All right, that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find more about all the stories that we mentioned on the show at slashfilm.com and linked inside the show notes for this episode. Slash Film Daily is typically published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thanks so much for listening, and we will talk to you all tomorrow.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.